Lunch with Leon is brought to you by Total Care, the UK experts in lifting and testing equipment for commercial vehicle workshops. Visit totalcare.co.uk and learn about their market-leading mobile column lifts, fixed post lifts, brake testers, inspection pits, and more. Total Care, lifting business one vehicle at a time.
And welcome to Lunch with Leon, where I invite you to join me with my lunch guests from around the world of transport. My guest this episode is my great friend and podcast co-host, Sarah Sloman. Sarah has her own podcast series here at ITT Hub, where she presents Talking Net Zero. Check over there at itthub.net for details of Sarah's really great episodes. When she isn't broadcasting, she's the Zero Emission Mobility Lead for Energy and Infrastructure at Foot Anstey LLP. We decided it was long overdue and we should swap some notes. In fact, we've been talking for quite a while, and then we realised it was about time we started recording.
That's lovely. So we better do some material we can broadcast.
So we better do some work, yeah, although this is lovely.
This is absolutely so.
Where's the wine then? You promised me wine, Leon. Where's the wine?
Okay, I'll get the wine. But before our guests joined us, we were talking about Bristol, weren't we?
Bristol has changed so much, and all for the better, all for the better. Lots of pedestrianisation, lots of lovely boutique shops and high-end as well. Loads of cafes and restaurants, mostly independent. It's fiercely independent, Bristol, always will be.
One of the things I found interesting about Bristol was that out in some of the inner suburbs, especially in the sort of university areas, there are people with cars who dare not move them because they won't get their car parking space back. So these cars have been there for months and months and months, and they only get so they've got this asset that is deteriorating and depreciating, which they dare not move because the next most valuable asset, which is the space it's parked in, would disappear.
And was this before or after the residence parking scheme?
Both, actually, both. It predated the residence parking.
Now, I have a lot of admiration for the lady who is an unsung hero who helped to implement the residence parking scheme because, and it is a controversial scheme and always will be, we were on different sides of the fence. So she had her orders within Bristol City Council to go ahead and implement this scheme and do the consultation. And at the time, I was working as a sort of business engagement manager who was in charge of a group of brilliant people fully trained in behaviour change to go out and talk to people and find out what it was that they needed in order to leave the car at home, which is exactly what we want. And so this whole residence parking scheme sent the business and employment world into huge outcry and upset, really emotive language being used because people's lives were forced to change in a very short space of time. And all of a sudden, people who were happy to drive into the city, but not the city centre, and who would utilise a lot of the quiet residential streets to leave their car free of charge and then walk the last 2 miles or whatever it was to their workplace, were no longer allowed to do that. And prior to that, businesses were sort of selling car parking or charging a premium for it in the city centre. So all of a sudden, out of nowhere, people found themselves with nowhere to leave their vehicle whatsoever, which only had a detrimental effect on the people's streets half a mile away. So the problem was shunted out of the city centre. But the city centre did start to achieve what it needed to, which is that people on those residential streets had somewhere to park their car because they lived there. Whereas before, those people who lived there didn't stand a chance. So we saw cycling go up and we saw bus patronage go up. And we also saw streets becoming way too congested that even fire engines and service vehicles can't go through. So whatever you do in life, particularly with transport planning, you will shunt the problem elsewhere. It is like coastal erosion, but with cars.
Yeah, no, you're so right. And of course, so Bristol had that rather wonderful George Ferguson as mayor?
Correct. Love George Ferguson.
Who always seemed to be wearing sneakers and a
red
pastel red-coloured blazer. And red trousers, that's right, red trousers.
Every time.
Now, and he, of course, is a case study in that, isn't he? He went on a massively pro-public transport agenda and got voted out because...
I'm afraid so. And with everything only ever being 4 years at a time, his position... He didn't get re-elected, and the person who did get elected instead was very much pro-car, pro-employment, pro-person. And that coincided quite perfectly with a shift in economic downturn, in loss of jobs, in people's poverty being forefront of everyone's mind. And so I can completely see why that transition happened, because if your able to get to work and you have access to a car and a slight increase in public transport costs bothers you, then you aren't going to be concerned. But having somebody to tell everyone you must leave your car behind, you must cycle, you must, this kind of you must attitude became not welcome. And I was sad because I did vote for George. So I was living in Bristol at the time. But I understand why he didn't get his new position. And it made me sad that he didn't get his new position. However, Marvin Rees has worked wonders in the city, whether you like him or loathe him. Nobody, political views always split everyone, so it doesn't matter which side of the fence you fall on there. Definitely everybody who comes into position does make changes, and they're usually positive, otherwise they just wouldn't be allowed.
No, it is the feature of democracy, isn't it? Because 4 years is not really long enough to do anything. And I remember when I first was talking to Boris when he was Mayor of London about certain congestion charging type schemes you might adopt. And I said to him, if you tell me that you want to do this in the first 6 months of your 4 years, by the time it's been designed, by the time it's gone to judicial review, by the time it's come back, and by the time we've built it, you might just, if you're lucky, see it the week before your term of office is up. Because 4 years, it'll take us four years to get that sort of thing through. So if you don't make any decisions within the first 6 months, then we won't be able to deliver it for you inside your mayoralty. So that's a really important thing. And I wonder how many people who become mayors of metropolitan cities are not ready to make those sorts of decisions that soon. And so, in fact, end up gambling they'll get a second term in order that the things that they decided on in the first term get delivered in the second term. And indeed, in London, the Santander cycle scheme in London was actually a Ken Livingston initiative. He didn't stay up long enough to enjoy it.
Agree. So, and then, of course, it was called Forest Bags. Now we must refer to it as Santander scheme. But the whole process of renewing political power and getting new people in is definitely too short-term, and the whole theme of short-term, including short-term funding cycles or short-term kickstart programs or short-term central government funding trickled out to local authorities who then have to put a team together because they had to slim down their staff, so then they have to go through consultancy process, and consultancy process has overheads, and a lot of the funding is capital and doesn't have any revenue, and so you end up with these huge infrastructural projects and you have great teams at your fingertips that you can instigate through your frameworks and your consultant frameworks. But what you really need is consistency in-house with streetworks engineers, excellent planners, brilliant people who can pull together the scheme from its vision, from your new person in power and whatever they've said, through to people on the ground who actually deliver this stuff. And those are the unsung heroes of reaching net zero. The local authority employees are those genius people behind the scenes who really know what their region needs. They understand every last part of it, and they have to kind of shape themselves into a central government mold. And that just isn't possible. And I just think time and time again, having this funding is brilliant. Having social media filled yesterday with announcements about charging infrastructure and the need for more on street and the need for more lamppost charging. Do you know what I saw? Engineers coming forward, biting their nails. Who's going to pay for this? Who's going to maintain it? Where are the revenue budgets going to come from? How will I be sure that this asset is going to be managed and monitored and controlled? And what happens when average Joe pulls up and the street lamp charging isn't working? Well, the private sector will tell you, depends on the contract. The maintenance schedule will be in the contract. We need somebody to sign up to this for the outset. But again, who are these people? Are they available within half an hour? Because that car driver needs to leave the car behind. And so often we see a solution and a problem, but the reality being slightly separate. Or let's not talk about that. Let's put the reality under the rug somewhere. Blame someone else. So a political leader can come in with these amazing ideas, and you're quite right, if they haven't implemented them or got buy-in within the first 6 months, then it's highly unlikely that the entire fruition through to completion is going to be a full process. It's actually quite likely that people are going to get very cross, very angry, shout at each other and point their fingers. But the underlying truth is that person was voted in with an excellent idea. That's what won the hearts and minds during the vote. So it's heartbreaking when it's really narrowly close, and somebody who's already been in post has to then leave But what you really need is that consistency of employees behind the scenes in the local authority who still, trust me, drive through whatever it was they were already working on. So the legacy remains, and that's really important.
Yes. I was going to ask you, because you were talking about on-street charging, I've often wondered if the on-street charging issue isn't overblown in some cases, because if I look at the range of a typical family electric car, which is capable of, I don't know, 150 or 200 miles, maybe. I mean, that's a week's driving for most families. So are we too hung up on the on-street charging? Because under those conditions, most people could charge on a Sunday afternoon and have enough electricity in their batteries to last them till the following Saturday.
On a predictable basis, I mean, it's great that that's a predictable number. And I agree, the average family probably doesn't move their vehicle more than 200 miles in a week. And hopefully they're utilising public transport or self-propelled, you know, walking, cycling in the meantime. But what it doesn't help is when you are on the hoof, on the hop, or doing a longer journey, of course. And so we know from previous on-street trials that if you're lucky to get a space, or if you live somewhere where population density isn't such a worry, then hopefully you will be able to end your 200-mile journey and then recharge once you're home. But this is the problem. We know between sort of 35 and 40% of the UK's population will not have access to driveway charging. So there has to be a case for street light and on-street charging. But I do find myself swinging slightly more towards in favour of the public charging forecourts and destination charging. So suites of low powered, you know, 3-pin sockets even in multi-storey car parks will be an absolute godsend for many, many people.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things into play, aren't there? One is, of course, we don't want a car-led recovery out of COVID. And there's a real danger, isn't there? I don't know whether you've found this. I mean, I've spent all of my life, my professional life, trying to persuade people out of cars and onto mass transit. And we hadn't been doing too badly recently, because the green agenda in particular, young people have become much more focused. So we were making progress, and public transport was growing in many cases, certainly on rail for a long time. It had been in London on bus, and we were making really good progress. Numbers of young people without a driving license was increasing, all those ingredients. But now, of course, with the pandemic, it feels like all those people who we'd nearly got over the hill or just over the hill have now completely slid backwards, because they're now able to fall back on this whole new reason, which is their own personal safety, because they can travel in their own cocoon. And I really worry that public transport will have this stigma that goes with being close to strangers in a post-pandemic period, that will mean that we've lost quite a bit of the momentum that we had built up previously.
I share your concern. I too have literally devoted my life to sustainable transport and trying to do that modal shift and just see towns and cities designed and infrastructure implemented in a way that is actually quite anti-car. And I'm not saying anti-car, I'm actually saying anti-single occupancy vehicle car. So I'm talking about the people who don't even enjoy, but do drive less than 2 or 3 miles to their place of work, wherever they need to go. These individuals are so fascinating. And I know this from 4 or 5 years of working on that project I described earlier as the business engagement manager, with these people highly stressed in traffic, paying through the nose to use that vehicle to get to work and back. And they want something new. And enter left of stage, the Voi scooter or the e-bike or anything that gives those people some fun in their day. This is a mode of transport where you don't need Lycra or some hugely expensive bike that you're going to lock up underneath your building. And I should know, I have plenty of very lovely bikes. I'm very spoiled. However, when you're at work, you just want to transport your laptop, your clothing of choice, and arrive not a hot mess. You want to be able to go straight into your meeting without all this faff of getting changed. And that's what this micromobility offer has seen. Now, the point about people getting back into cars and not on public transport, we just don't know yet. The numbers we're seeing are false because they're not real. They're not as much time as we've monitored before. But what's exciting is with the rise of people working from home and post-COVID showing us that we don't actually need to go anywhere, your invites on your inbox before, you would have probably said, yes, let's meet up, let's have lunch, let's do a drink, let's do coffee. And whilst it's sad that some of those things have been lost, we can just choose now whether we do or don't travel. And most people will continue to work from home, even if office spaces are provided. So I'm hoping the streets will be just as congested as before, but not worse.
No, that makes no. I understand that. I guess I'm concerned that we've lost some of the momentum. But as you say, all the micro mobility stuff is fascinating, and it seems because we're just waiting here in London for the outcome of the London trial tender bids. So the World and his wife has bid for probably 3 contracts to run e-scooter trials in London, and as at today, we're just waiting to hear who the 3 lucky winners might be. But I have to say that, unlike a number of other modes, including, by the way, jogging, because I've never seen a jogger smiling. It doesn't look like the sort of happy thing to do. The people on e-scooters are very happy. They are just enjoying themselves, aren't they?
They are very, very happy, indeed. And I remember one of the best campaigns I ever was proud to be part of was when Bristol and South Gloucestershire, so Greater Bristol, was awarded cycling city status. And we ran this fab campaign, which just asked people not about eco stuff and not about health or saving money, but why do you cycle? And our favorite person we interviewed was, he just literally replied, because it makes me smile. So he found that in his day, and again, post-COVID, there are some stressed people out there. We are all working 20, 30% more than our contracted hours every single week, week in, week out. We all have external pressures, whether that's homeschooling or family who we're looking after. But what I'm looking forward to is when that flexibility returns, when the bus is available, when you have an app that says, hey, take the bus today because it'll save you 26 minutes on your journey. Plus, you can have this discount voucher for a delicious coffee from your friendly local trip who we know because we've inputted it onto the app. So having this localism injected into the post-COVID recovery would be a fantastic step towards people reclaiming their time, their health, the enjoyment of the journey. So sitting on a bus is so underrated because you can be on your phone or you can listen to music or you can look out the window or you can reply to work emails. You can do whatever you like. Whereas when you're driving, your hands maybe might as well be handcuffed. You can't do anything. And so public transport will still have its place. I just hope that public transport becomes more luxurious somehow. So less about functionality and more about choice. So you want to get, I love first Great Western trains because those new beautiful Hitachi ones, loads of space, nice comfy seats. You can actually get a laptop, well, sort of get a laptop propped up on the tiny tray. So it's just nice to pay extra for something good. And there's the difference. People don't factor in the whole life cost equivalent of using public transport, nor do they massively factor in the potential enjoyment they might experience from it. Milton Keynes from here takes 4 hours. If you drove a car, it'd be less. It'd be like 2 and a bit. But it never is 2 and a bit because there's always traffic and you always need to stop and charge because I drive electric and it's a medium range / low range. But if I sit on a train, I can watch end to end RuPaul's Drag Race and any other thing that I might want to watch on my phone. And I arrive on my journey super relaxed and happy and I feel like I've had my time. So sustainable commute gives you your time back.
I mean, I don't have a car here in London at all. What would I do with it? Even though I have a private parking space in the underground car park. But in fact, it's the most underused and expensive underground car parking space in the whole world because I have a bus service very close. I'm within walking distance to one underground station, and I have a range of car club cars in the street. And the car club cars are just ideal. It's exactly what I need for those occasional journeys that I have to do that are just awkward by public transport because of either the time of day or because of the things I have to carry with me. Then the car club cars are just brilliant. But of course, not being part of the TfL ecosystem meant that the car clubs have struggled because people find them a little hard to work out how to use them. They're timid. They don't quite know how they work. They see them. If you stop them in the street and say, if there was a car club car on your street, might you use it? They'll say yes. But they're then prevented with a number of obstacles about, you know, what's the right thing to do. And in fact, until you get the hang of it, it is slightly awkward because there's a sort of security device that allows you to enter the car, which is peculiar to each type of operator. Then there is a mechanism by which hidden away. There's a place where you put a card and key and a number, and that's you having possession of the car for a time. So all of those things are just very slightly awkward, which is a pity, because I've always thought that car clubs, and in particular zero emission car clubs, would have a real valuable place to be. Because I think whilst you can persuade people who've got two cars to live with one, persuading somebody that's got one car to live with none, I think is very difficult. And they will always cite those awkward journeys, and they'll always cite those occasions when they need to pick up their child and stuff them in the car and rush them to A&E. So they want some sort of backstop to make sure that they're never exposed. So I am sorry that car clubs have never been as successful as they might have been, because I think they're quite a good way of persuading people out of being a car owner.
I just think they haven't had their time. I really don't think they've had their time yet. I think it's coming, because again, when everybody's forced to reevaluate their assets, and in my case, we do have two vehicles. I'm going to be leasing a brand new EV mid-March. I've just sold my MG. And at the moment, we've only got one car, and that's fine because logistics are fairly unpressured at the moment. Where the car club comes in, you've cited it perfectly. I can remember in Bristol, there's a car club within a mile of everyone in Bristol. There just is. That's how they've structured the city, because Bristol does do clever leadership things like that. But just knowing that it's there. But then you can speak to your neighbour who's never seen one, never heard of one, doesn't understand what one is. And then enter here the importance of word of mouth and leading by example. And sure enough, if you plotted on a map all of the people who had memberships with these car clubs, and we've got multiple operators in the Bristol region, some of which are zero emission, you will see a little pocketing type trend where so-and-so recommended so-and-so, and the refer a friend program just goes on and on and on. But with all behavior change and with all sustainability methods, it's always about, what do you want to be seen doing? Is this a popular choice? Are you an early adopter, or are you in fact already woke? Please delete that bit. I can't believe I said that out loud. I'm kidding. But if you accept that you can't carry on how you were before, but you want a slight incremental change, then having access to a car club vehicle, which is right there, an hourly rate, but the insurance excess is regularly cited as the one thing that puts people off the most. Because even though the hourly rate is small and the mileage is your fault, depends how far you go, if anything happens to you on that vehicle at that time, the excess is massive. And that doesn't matter if you've been driving 40 years or 4 years, you will be liable to the same excess. And there's no waivers. So that's a huge barrier to overcome.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. You're right. And because people always want to be protected against the downside risk, because you could be involved in an accident, for example, that wasn't your fault, but where the other person disappeared, and you'd still be liable. So
when you leave the car behind, something could happen to it, and say you haven't logged out at the right time, and you didn't take the photo. The funniest thing that ever happened to me with a car club vehicle was I was quite heavily pregnant, and I dropped my stepson off at what was Cubs, and I had to go and get this car club vehicle to go and get the poor lad back again. And in between me dropping him off and leaving the vehicle back in the spot and then walking back to the car and so on, somebody had obviously been shopping, and I think an egg had fallen out of their shopping bag, and rather than putting it back in their shopping bag, they placed it in the central console, like where the cups go. And so I drove off to this lovely little, it was like a Yaris, just to go and get my stepson, and getting on a bit late at night, and I'm just looking at this egg, and then my head span off into this sort of, well, what do I do? Because if I take the egg, will that be somebody reporting me for taking that? You just, when you're borrowing an asset, when you're using somebody else's vehicle, you don't treat it as your own. You treat it like it's perfect, and you need to be really careful. But you actually don't. You need to remember that the people using that car are in your community. It's in your street. It's in your street corner or your park. So don't worry. I probably knew whose egg that was if I asked around on Facebook. But but yeah, and another time the flip side was true. I turned up and it had really suspicious and very odd things in there. And I just rejected the booking, got my money back, and they were very apologetic. And yeah, there was like weird little black rubber gloves and a lot of mud. And I just don't know what somebody had used that vehicle for before me. So I just thought it looked like a murder scene. I wanted nothing to do with it. I'd prefer the egg.
Yeah, sure. Well, my car club sob story, of course, is one of those barriers to entry, because I wasn't familiar with the system the very first time I hired one. And the very first time I hired one, I went out into the street and hired it. and drove it and put it in my underground parking space here so as I could load it with the things that I couldn't carry on public transport. But instead of just locking it, I logged out. Mm-hmm. Now, I rang them up immediately. I'm sorry, I've made a terrible mistake here. I've logged out. And they said, that's no problem. They said, we can unlock it remotely for you by remote control. But of course, they couldn't because in my underground car park, there's no cellular signal. So I found myself now a little pressed for time with a vehicle that was logged out and was no longer able to be accessed by the car club company, which is the sort of thing that people are frightened of doing, you know, and that's one of the reasons why they don't do it.
This is a recorded podcast, but sadly you can't see me completely corpsing at this story because it's always the most intelligent people that do the silliest things, Leon. Oh my goodness. But it's easily done. It's so easily done, isn't it?
It is. And people like to be in their comfort zones, and trying something new is always very hard, isn't it? So I can understand why people are reticent. So I was going to say, bearing in mind you run a program about net zero, we've managed not to have argued about battery electric versus hydrogen once in this whole podcast, which is a record because most of my guests either want to have that argument, argue on behalf of one of them. So I had Isbrand Ho from BYD going on about how good battery electric is. I had Joe Bamford from Rise Hydrogen and Wrightbus, of course, going on about hydrogen. But the best lesson I got from somebody was to say that for people like us, where we are mixing, if you like, with people in the net zero areas, is to just keep reminding people the only constants are the free energy that is provided by the sun and the wind and the desire for us all to make wheels rotate. And how you get that free energy into traction is a whole complicated ball game, which is horses for courses, different things for different applications. But never lose sight of the fact that the sun and the wind is the source of the free energy, and all you're trying to do is make something move. Now, I thought that was a really refreshing way to think about it, because people usually dive in halfway through the argument and are pro VHS or Betamax.
Yes, and I don't consider myself a fence sitter. I just don't think there's any fences to sit on. It's a very open playing field as far as I see. And there's no such thing ever as free energy, because, and bearing in mind my history and who I am and what I stand for and how pro wind, tidal and solar I am, and hydrogen more increasingly, the more I learn, you can't get that energy to where you need it to be without a very expensive grid. So in the same way that we are benefiting right now from not paying tax on our battery electric vehicles, that road is going to need to be repaired at some point. And I'm not against paying for it. I've always said, I wish that the selling point for electric vehicles wasn't centered around saving money, because the total cost of ownership models and everything applied on top over the space of, say, 3 years, you might save some money. You may just save some money, and that's fantastic. But at the end of it all, people should really be prepared to pay for what they want to do, what they want to use. And this brings me dangerously close to my second gripe at all times with all things green and sustainable, is let's take everyone with us, because there is a huge danger of having social exclusion as a huge problem on our plate, where we've got people making fantastic choices with their energy suppliers and their vehicles and retrofitting their homes. And then you've also got swathes of people who, for this, is laughable, and they must deal with whatever is presented to them, whether they don't care if it's an electric bus or a hydrogen bus or a biomass bus. It's just a bus to them, and that's what is required to get them to their jobs or places of employment. So that's never, ever going to go away. And realizing that there's no such thing as free energy wherever it comes from, it is definitely the first step. I mean, £16 billion, is that what the grid upgrade is required to be just to cater for wind alone? Like, we know from Cornish examples, we can generate plenty of wind, and we have plenty of solar and tidal power capabilities on this fantastic island. What we don't have is the transmission network upgrade budget to get everybody access to that clean energy. So this is where nuclear is so essential, and this is where the decommission of other more polluting power sources have to happen, because we've proven that through science and popular opinion. But there's no such thing as free energy. And I used to band around a silly hashtag called #smugface, because that brilliant smug face that we all wear when we all know that we're putting the recycling out, where does the recycling really go? We know this now. When we put our foot down in our brilliant electric vehicle with our smug face, well, where did that power come from? We know now. So we just have to remember that we are very clever. We create things all the time, but everything everywhere has the yin and the yang, the pro and the con, and the cost or not. So the hydrogen debate will never go away. And I just think, as you said, it's horses for courses and everything in its place, the right tool for the right job. And one thing that really inspired me was the Scottish project, whereby they were creating green hydrogen with a surplus of wind energy, and they were using that to power the passenger ferry, so much so that they ended up doubling the number of ferry travel that they could offer because they had so much surplus. That is just the panacea, isn't it? Microgeneration, the place you need it, doesn't need a UK-wide transmission, and people locally benefit from that, having that in their backyard. So the NIMBYism element isn't relevant.
And Graham Cooper on one of my episodes put forward this suggestion, which is sort of slightly lifted out of Victorian history, where you built railway stations and therefore people put houses and factories and businesses and towns grew up as a result of Victorian railways. And he said maybe the answer is that big transport operators set up their depots adjacent to substations. So they've got all the electricity they need literally on site. If that became a significant employer, either for public transport or for freight and logistics, around that would grow up housing stock, around that would grow up supermarkets and Cafe Nero and so on. And you could create communities that were centered on the local substation. Now, I think I accused him of trying to reverse engineer the whole of society in order to fit his business, which sounds a bit unkind, but there was just something in that, wasn't there? Another way of dealing with some problems, like how on earth are we going to get enough energy supply to these various places? An answer could also be, why don't we put the people who need it closer to the electricity supply that's there? And one of the things Graham did say is the adjacency, for example, of the motorway network to most of the overhead power on the grid is something as high as like 80%. So there's a very high proportion of electrical power of good quality and size adjacent to our major trunk roads. And so there was just something interesting in that thought. We spend a lot of time, don't we, thinking about how do we get the power to the user, but maybe there's a possibility to get the users closer to the power.
Absolutely. And I know from infrastructural delivery that the DNO's primary concern is that you contact them first to say, this is what I'm thinking about, and this is where I want to build this thing. What do you think about that? And then their second word will be, well, have you thought about this site? Because this is where the power is. So luckily, that sort of conversation is already happening. And it's no different to prehistoric times where animals would find the watering hole. It's the same thing. We need now to turn our preferences on our head. But sadly, we are fussy, spoilt humans who want to live in vast, expensive places and use up all the power. We don't want to share. And this idea of sharing assets or giving back, ugh, gross. Are you going to pay me for that? This is kind of the normal attitude of life. I mean, even I asked you if you were going to buy me a wine for coming on this podcast with you.
And so there we have it. Our conversation ended where it started, about where the wine was coming from. And my guest today has been Sarah Sloman, who is a co-host of mine as she presents Talking Net Zero across at ittHub.net. Many thanks to Sarah for sharing some time with me, and some interesting stuff there for sure. We'll be back for the next episode of Lunch with Leon, coming very soon.